Now, we've seen plenty of talk the last couple of days about plagiarism on YouTube, and it's got all the different communities looking inwards and evaluating their own little sphere and seeing what may or may not be a problem. And, well, since I'm a pyramid idiot that likes science a lot too, I figured I would weigh in and say a few things as I see them in our little sphere here, besides the obvious, which is, duh, don't steal other people's stuff. Don't rip off other people's crap and read it as your own. Don't steal other people's graphics and call it your own. All basic stuff, right? Okay, beyond that, we're going to get into like the philosophizing side of it. So to get us there, we're going to go cryptid. I'm going to have us a little bit of fun getting there. And I'm going to tell this in story form. So at the end of it, I will go ahead and tell you any holes that need to be poked in this story. But to begin with, we're just going to give you a story that should take us right into that whole plagiarism side of things. Hopefully should illustrate my point semi-well, I hope. Anyway, hi, my name's Dan, welcome to Dedunking, and this is the legend of the Piesaw Bird. Uatago, chief of the Illini, has a serious problem on his hands. An issue his father and his grandfather had no experience with, and one the Wisdom Keeper also had no knowledge of. Uatago was completely alone in this. His people had plenty to eat. The mastodon hunt has been as good as any in living memory. The rains were plentiful and the forests were teeming with berries and the fields had so much grain that they had begun to pick and choose only the best to eat. Fish were pulled from the Mississippi River and dried on racks all across the settlement, and vigilant sentries sat on the bluffs overlooking the village and the river. But those guards offered little more than a few seconds of warning when the real troubles began. On that day, several of the Illini people were waist-deep in the water, fishing with spears, when the sentries on the cliff sounded the alarm. Everyone looked up to the bluffs, but the sun had suddenly gone dark, and they struggled to see. Those who could take it in were horrified, a gigantic bird with a body the size of a calf, a face similar to a human face but with sharp teeth and a long beard, talons the length of a man's forearm, and wings the size of a horse were descending onto the river. Those caught fishing in the water scrambled to escape, but it was no use. The Piesaw Bird chose a victim, stole him away, and flew into a cave high in the bluffs to eat him. As the screams of their fellow diminished into the distance, the people slowly contemplated what had happened, and in a matter of minutes, full panic had set in. The sentries refused to return to their exposed posts on the cliffs. The fishers were in shock, and the few who could speak refused to go back into the water. The grain gatherers were equally frightened. There's no place to hide in the grasslands, they said. Only hunting game and picking fruit in the forest seemed to offer itself as a solution, so that was a decision the council made that very evening. Until the Piesaw Bird had left or had been slain, they would stick to the forests. Even this provided a limited solution, as the creature would use the caves that were in the hills and bluffs to pop out of the forest in different locations, still grab somebody and run off, but it was the best solution that they had. 6 years passed, and in the intervening time, over 200 people were eaten by the Piesaw, and the Illini way of life had completely changed. Each year they stored less for the winter, and each winter the rations were lighter than the years before. Uatago knew this couldn't continue, but his bravest warriors had proven ineffective against the beast. Arrows bounced off of its hide, spears shattered, and the creature would ravage those who had tried to injure it. With no clear answer on the horizon, Uatago went into the forest to fast and commune with the spirits in the hopes that they would offer some sort of an answer. After a month had passed, he had the dream he was hoping for. He returned to his people, haggard, tired, and hungry, but they saw the hope in his eyes and began to cheer as loudly as they dared to. After a quick meal, Uatago inspected the warriors he had left amongst his people and chose the 20 he felt best suited for this task. This was to be a test of courage and restraint, not of strength, so a lot of men who thought they would be selected were not, and a rumor began to circulate that perhaps Uatago had lost his mind when he was fasting. He took his selected few warriors to the Wisdom Keeper and had their arrows coated in a poison concocted from snake venom. Each man had only one arrow poisoned, as each would only get one shot. Early the next morning, before the sun rose, Uatago and his 20 men snuck carefully onto the top of the bluffs where it had all began. Each warrior carefully hid himself in the forest, treating this hunt as the most important they had ever been on. Uatago also hid, but he sat in the edge of a clearing near the cliff that overlooked the water. When the sun rose, Uatago stepped out into the open, and standing on the rock, he waved his arms high in the air in the sun's first rays, and began to sing the death song as loud as he could. This noise attracted the Piesaw, and the monster flew into the air quickly and circled for an attack. Uatago steeled himself and sang louder, closing his eyes and placing his trust in the spirits and his kinsfolk. The Piesaw reached Uatago, and 20 arrows shot from the tree line, all striking the Piesaw. While many shattered or bounced, a few did strike home, and the poison was devastating. Immediately, the bird coiled and shrieked, tumbling off the edge of the cliff and into the water below, where it thrashed about until it died. And the people were never troubled by such a creature again. So to thank the spirits and to keep memory of the Piasaw, Uatago had two beasts painted on the cliffs overlooking the river. These paintings were seen by French explorers in the early 17th century, and with that, the legend of the Piasaw entered into the realm of Western knowledge. I added several details to this to make it more of a story instead of a historical account. Think of it as the Mr. Balin version of the Piasaw bird story, if I was that good of a storyteller. But I still need to cite my sources below, even though they just form the backbone of what I just told you. Now, besides those extra little details that I added, this was a story that I was told growing up in the 80s, and I lived really near to that area. As a matter of fact, the high school that I would have gone to had I stayed in that area, that was their mascot, Go Southwestern. The Piasaw bird was their mascot, excuse me. And in those links below, you'll find the tale told by Dr. John Russell in 1836. And this is the first time we have real mention of the myth of the Piasaw bird. Before that, we don't have any references to this story. We have the French trappers that in the 1600s saw the paintings on the cliff. And we have other people that after that reference them. But we don't have any mythological stories from the Native Americans or any provenance or chain of evidence or however you want to call it for this story. It just seems to pop up in 1836. The French explorers' art doesn't show wings, and they never called it the Piasaw bird. They just called it the Piasaw. And that artwork was probably a few centuries old by the time they saw it, but sadly it's completely gone now. In the Civil War era, those cliffs were heavily mined for limestone and like chopped back a long ways from the river from where they used to be until they got to the limestone that's not so good anymore, and they quit mining them. Then they repainted the doggone thing on there. That's what I saw when I was a kid. Then they put a metal sign up because the paint kept peeling off the limestone because it was low-grade limestone. So now they have this crappy metal sign up that doesn't even really like have any of the coolness of what the painting, at least on the rock, at least looked kind of spirity and cool. It just looks like crap now. The caves still exist, but they're pretty modified, and you know, there's a lot of them. They're off limits, but kids still party in them, covered in graffiti and whatnot. Here on the screen now, you're seeing an image of real footage from the cave, and the links down below because it's not my footage. In front of the painting slash sign, there's a plaque that has the story I just told you on there now. But there is, again, no Native American version of it. We don't really know where this story exactly came from. It just kind of pops up in the 1830s. And this brings me to the plagiarism end of things. Now, here in the alternate history Pyramidiate community, we all recognize that like we're grabbing off of little pieces of each other's work and putting together our own little theories, and it's all patchwork of different people's ideas stitched together with our own opinions. Pretty much all of us get that. But people on the outside look in, and they will frequently call people a plagiarist for example, Ben Knott's constantly referencing the fact that he got his vases from Chris Dunn, or Jim Knott constantly referencing the fact that he got the Atlantis Reich hat thing from the Gaia TV. People will accuse that as plagiarism. Now, both of these guys have grabbed that and ran with it, and if you think of vases, you don't think of Chris Dunn, and if you think of Reich hat, you don't think of Gaia TV. But they have made the community is aware that they're the, you know, that they've referenced this stuff. However, they don't do it all the time, so it's frequently a talking point used against them, and it's a bad look. If they would just reference it more, I think. So both of you guys end up seeing this. I just put the little damn extra little blurb in their thing. Put it with your links that you cut and paste each time. It'll make life a whole lot easier for all of us involved that actually get in the trenches and argue with the science-y type people. Now, another reason it's a big deal to do this is because it establishes that chain of ideas or that provenance of thought. And this myth, for example, there well could have gone back much further than that. It may well have been recorded in other books from that time. There, hell, there may be one sitting in a library right now in southern Illinois just waiting to be stumbled across that lends credence to that version of the myth. But since Doctor didn't reference it, we can't find it. And it's assumed to be an invention of his own. No, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that he didn't invent it. It looks like it did, but that's my point. If he didn't invent it, his lack of citing that source 150 years, 200 years later, it looks like he lied. It looks like he just made it up. So by just saying, hey man, I got this idea from so-and-so, I got this idea from so-and-so, just to give an example, in a recent video I did about the bad archaeologists around the world, when I was talking about Zahi Hawass and talking about Mark Lehner, I made sure and mentioned that that idea came from History for Granted. And the way I did it was just by taking a clip from him and slapping it right in the video. But let people know that this isn't my idea first. The kernel of that thing, it was just a little kernel and I ran with it, but that came from him. And so I think it's important that we do that, just so in certain things that will really matter a lot. And it also looks a little bit better, makes us look a little bit more professional, a little bit less like the herd of cats that we are. And I know a lot of you don't really care to cater at all to the skeptic side of the arguing, but some of us really do. And in my opinion, having those guys like poke holes at some of the things that we bring out there, you know, it's a distillation process, in my opinion. We get real mysteries, and we need some skeptics to weed out the stuff that's not completely mysterious. It's been mistaken for a mystery. So I don't just, you know, I don't discourage them from weighing in on our stuff. As a matter of fact, I encourage it. I just, you know, try to keep them on the rails where they don't just start just attacking out of nowhere, which any of us who does this for any amount of time and looks in the comments is going to have seen that on both sides. But anyway, the one more thing that's really important to remember about plagiarism in our community: if you do get an idea from a smaller channel, shout them out. Make sure you cite that. Like, I'm only at like 20,000 subscribers at the time of filming this, but if there's a guy with 50 subscribers and I get a kernel of an idea from him and I shout him out, he's liable to gain enough subscribers that it'll make his day, right? And that will encourage him to do it again. And if he's adding a little piece of patchwork to my quilt, maybe he'll make another good piece of patchwork, man. But if I discourage it by stealing it and then like just, well, then he's not going to want to do it again, is he? And then we're going to be one more thinker short in the community. And a lot of times people that have really good ideas are just shit at making videos or shit at presenting them to the public. But if you look through and grab it, you can. So my point is at least give these people credit when credit is due. All right, well, thank you so much for watching. I hope the mingling of topics here wasn't too much for you. I hope you enjoyed the story of the Piasaw bird, at least. And I hope that you found my hot take on the whole philosophical aspect of this not too insane. If you like the thinking side of crap and you like weird stories about ancient history and whatnot, this is definitely a place you might enjoy. Definitely might. So you might definitely click a button and you might definitely see you next time. Definitely might have a good day, too.